If the level was below 200 ppm, the men would open blast door 9, walk down the long cableway, enter the silo, and vent the Stage 1 fuel tank. 5. The airmen would bring a portable vapor detector with them, and if it registered a vapor level higher than 200 ppm at any point during those first 4 steps, the men would get out of the launch complex as quickly as possible, leaving the doors open behind them. Colonel Scalloran wasn't happy with part of the plan. He was concerned about the rising heat in the silo, the risk that an oxidizer tank would rupture from the heat and the huge explosion that would follow. Working outdoors with PTS teams, he'd seen how sensitive the oxidizer could be to small increases in temperature. On a cold, clear day at a launch site in Arkansas, the stainless steel mesh of an oxidizer hose could get warm enough just from lying in the sun to blow off a poppet. He thought it would be foolish to enter the silo without knowing the tank pressures inside the missile. It wasn't worth the risk. It would put these young men in harm's way. Over the years, he'd found that some people at SAC headquarters treated maintenance crews and PTS guys like they were expendable. Scalloran suggested, on the net, that the two airmen should enter the launch control center first, check the tank pressures on the PTPMU, and turn on the purge fan to clear fuel vapor from the silo. They could always go into the silo later. General Levitt didn't appreciate the suggestion. "Scalloran, just be quiet and stop telling people what to do," he snapped. "We're trying to figure this thing out." "Roger, General," Scalloran replied. "You got that, Moser?" It was an awkward moment. Nobody liked to hear one of SAC's leading Titan II experts being told to shut up. Not long afterward, Charles E. Carnahan, a vice president at Martin Marietta who'd been quietly listening to the discussion, spoke up. "Little Rock, this is Martin Denver," Carnahan said. "Are you interested in any of our judgments in this matter?" "Of course," Levitt told him. "Go ahead." "If it was us, we would seriously consider not moving into the silo area for some number of hours." Carnahan was asked if he meant the silo or the entire launch complex. "I am talking about the launch complex," he said. "It is entirely possible that the leak is still leaking. It is our judgment that while the leak continues, the vapor content in the silo and the general area will continue to rise. The potential for a monopropellic explosion increases as the vapor content increases. Once the leak has leaked out, if you have no explosion, it is our judgment that the vapor content in the area will decrease. We are unclear as to the gain that is expected from an early entry, or an entry at this point in time into the complex area." After hours of debating what to do, the missile potential hazard team now had to ponder the advice of the company that built the missile. Do nothing. A small group of reporters stood along Highway 65 watching the Air Force trucks roll up. It was about 11:30, and Sid King was impressed by all the Air Force personnel and equipment that suddenly appeared. Crews from the local television stations in Little Rock pointed their lights and cameras at the vehicles as military police tried to keep the press off the access road. A cattle guard about 30 feet from the highway served as the line that civilians were prohibited to cross. The questions shouted by reporters were ignored. Sergeant Joseph W. Cotton, the public affairs officer who'd arrived with the disaster response force, had already told the press that there was a fuel leak and it was under control. Cotton refused to say anything more, and he gave reporters the phone number of SAC headquarters in Omaha in case they had any further questions. King and his friend Tom Phillips thought about sneaking closer to the launch complex to see what was happening. King knew Ralph and Reba Joe Parrish, who owned the farm to the north of the missile site. Although the Parrishes had been evacuated, King was sure they wouldn't mind his entering the property and heading west through their fields toward the silo. King and Phillips quietly discussed the plan, feeling confident they wouldn't get caught. It was dark out there. but they wondered what would happen if they were caught, and decided, for the time being, to stay put. PTS Team B unloaded their gear just past the cattle guard, along the road to the launch complex, relying on flashlights to see what they were doing. The television crews had better lights. "Man, those look like spacesuits," Sid King thought, as the refcos and their helmets were unpacked. He was struck by how young the airmen appeared. He'd expected to see gray-haired scientists and high-ranking Air Force officers coming to fix the missile. These guys were younger than him. They were kids. Once the refcos were laid out, the air packs filled and everything ready to go, Sergeant Hansen walked over to Colonel Morris. He told Morris that a couple of people would be sent through the access portal into the silo. Colonel Morris hadn't heard anything about a plan to re-enter the complex. "Hey, wait a minute," Morris said. "We're not doing anything until I get directions." Morris got on the radio to the command post and asked, "What's the plan?" He was told to stand by. They were still working on it. Colonel Moser asked SAC headquarters if they should follow Martin Marietta's advice. "Well, let's go over what we've got here," General Levitt said. About half an hour earlier, Levitt had called Governor Clinton in Hot Springs. Their conversation was brief and polite. He told Clinton that a team was about to re-enter the complex and that the situation was under control. Clinton thanked him for the update and went to bed. But Levitt had changed his mind. He decided that they should wait and allow the fuel vapor to dissipate before sending anyone near the missile. And he asked everyone on the net to discuss what had happened at 4-7 from the moment the socket was dropped. Jeff Kennedy lay on the grass atop a low hill. Silas Spann, a member of PTS Team B, sat beside him. Spann was one of the few African-Americans who worked in missile maintenance, and he stood out in this part of rural Arkansas. Whenever he walked into one of the local shops, people looked surprised. Kennedy and Spann could see the launch complex down below. A thick white cloud still floated from the vents. The two men wondered what would happen if the missile exploded. Would the blast doors and the silo door hold? Would they fully contain the blast? Both agreed that the doors would. They had faith in those big fucking doors. It was a warm, beautiful night with a slight breeze and plenty of stars in the sky. Don Green